This edition of the Monocle Arts Review was first broadcast on the 21st of October 2015 on Monocle 24. Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Ben Rylan. Today I'm joined by Matt Wolfe, theatre critic for the International New York Times, for a roundup of a few recent shows here in London. We'll begin with a tale of corruption and purity in a new production of Shakespeare's Measure for Measure at the Young Vic. Then we'll be at the Orange Tree Theatre for Terence Radigan's play French Without Tears. And finally, we'll finish off with a discussion on the premiere of a new play by Christopher Shin called Teddy Ferrara. That's all coming up on the Monocle Arts Review. Stay tuned. Welcome to the show, Matt. Let's begin today's show at the Young Vic for Joe Hill Gibbons' rendition of the Shakespearean comedy Measure for Measure, a play all about corruption and sexual morality set in Vienna. The Financial Times described the show as a bold, wildly unorthodox staging of the play, and it sounds like there's certainly a lot going on visually at the very least. Tell us a little bit about what's happening on stage.
Yeah, bold and visually unorthodox is certainly a good way to describe it. This director, Joe Hill Gibbons, never does anything the way you might expect. He'll take a classic play and he'll, you know, have the music of Beyoncé, or he'll throw lots of just glop or goo on top of the actors. This begins, it's set in a very licentious, corrupt Vienna, a Vienna that we're led to believe has been morally debased. And so in order to communicate that to the 2015 audience, the cast in the beginning sort of have to climb through a series of what look like inflatable sex dolls. And that's not in Shakespeare's text, one hastens to add.
Are you certain? I haven't read it, but it doesn't sound like
I'm absolutely certain, Ben. And it's all a way of communicating in a visual shorthand the climate in which the play operates. And, you know, the thing that people don't often say enough about Shakespeare is that in his day, 400 years ago, he was a man of the people. His plays were popular. They weren't highbrow and arcane. So I think that a production like this wants to preserve that spirit and sort of suggest, how would this play land in a way that makes sense now if Shakespeare were here to be sitting right by my right ear? And this is one way of doing it. The result is that the text is very heavily cut. I don't know the exact percent, but I would guess probably at least 30% of it. And the comedy of it, because it is a comedy, but the comedy of it is very strange. And it's one of these Shakespeare plays where everyone is paired up at the end, but you kind of wonder why. And you also sort of wonder, like 10 minutes after the play ends, will they still be together? So there's a lot going on in the production. I highly recommend it.
Now, I'm interested to hear your thoughts about this, actually, the concept of updating a Shakespearean text, because it does almost seem as though we can either have it one way or the other. You've got the version of Macbeth that's in theatres at the moment with Michael Fassbender and Marion Cotillard, which is a very, very loyal adaptation of the play put to film. But then you've also got a lot of updates that happen to Shakespeare, which just completely change everything, which is almost what it sounds like has happened with A Measure for Measure. What are your thoughts on the concept of updating the text? Is it necessary sometimes to get the message across?
Well, it's important to point out the text itself hasn't been updated. I mean, the language that you're hearing at the Young Vic is Shakespeare's language. It's not as if they go, hey, bro, how you doing? What's happening, dude? It's not that. And there have been, you know, productions that have slightly gone down that line. It's more finding a visual correlative for now that makes sense of a play, you know, written 400 years ago. But the language is still intact. And what's lovely about this production, and one should give them a shout out, is that the three principal actors, Paul Reedy, Zubin Varla, and Romola Garry, all speak the language very well, but they also speak it very conversationally. And that's one of the things Joe Hill Gibbons is good at as well. You don't have that moment that you often do in Shakespeare thinking, what in heaven's name are they talking about? It's like adjusting to an old vinyl album played at the wrong speed. There's none of that. You kind of get right away what's going on. It's just finding a way to invite you into the strange, disordered, creepy world of this play.
So we've brought up Joe Hill Gibbons a bit already. Tell me a little bit about him, because this is actually something that sounds as though it's a little experiment he likes to put on a few different plays, isn't it?
Yeah, he's somebody who does a lot of stuff at the Young Vic, and he's worked elsewhere. He's worked at the National Theatre. He does, in my experience, mostly revivals, classic plays, not just Shakespeare, but others. He did a Martin McDonagh. He's done The Changeling. He did Edward II. But he never takes these plays and does them sort of embalmed in aspic. It's all about kind of breaking through centuries of maybe being too polite about the play and saying, I'm not having that. Let's be rude and messy and impolite. And it's interesting that the visuals in his plays are often messy, like all these sex dolls lying around.
Well, you can get your fix of sex dolls and impolite Shakespeare with Measure for Measure, which is on at the Young Vic until the 14th of November. Matt, we'll move on now to the Orange Tree Theatre in Richmond, where Terence Rattigan's smash hit play, French Without Tears, is showing. It's under the direction of the theatre's founder, Paul Miller. Now, Matt, for those who aren't familiar with the play, it has been around since 1936. Perhaps just bring us up to speed with what it's all about.
Sure. Well, I would be very surprised if most people were familiar with the play at all, because I had never seen it, and I'm a self-confessed Terence Rattigan groupie, and I was so excited when I saw this play was going to be done, because I thought, at last I'll get to see it. It was Rattigan's, he died many years ago, but it Rattigan's first great commercial success. But unusually for Rattigan, who's much better known for plays like Separate Tables and The Deep Blue Sea and Cause Celebre, Flare Path, this is a comedy, and Rattigan didn't write many comedies. And you can sort of see in 1936 why it did very well. The original cast included people like a very young Rex Harrison and a very young Jessica Tandy. So maybe some of these actors will go on to win Oscars themselves. It's basically about men who don't know what to make of women or are afraid of women socially, sexually. It's a bunch of young guys, English guys, in a sort of French school in France, not in England, where they're swatting up on their French so that they can, you know, enter the military and the world. And they are all kind of agog at the presence of these two women in their midst, one English, one French, and they really have no idea how to communicate with them. So A, they can't speak French, and B, they can't speak sort of male-female discourse. So they're kind of at two removes from language.
Now, it has been remarked by at least one reviewer that the plot and themes are quite limited, and a lot of the attitudes portrayed in the play tend to be a little bit symbolic of the chauvinism of the era. But I guess it is quite important to view things through the filter of the times in which they were written.
Yeah, and actually, I'm not sure that second critique, the chauvinism of the era, is entirely fair, because Rattigan, who was gay in his own life but didn't write so-called gay plays, whatever that would be, but he often wrote about male inarticulacy amongst men and women and men and men. And I think this is actually a quite cunning critique of the male inability to communicate, which in this case just happens to be directed against these women who happen to be at the French school, but it could be any other setting. It's a caprice, though. I wouldn't want to overstate the case. It's not a profound play. It's not a particularly meaty play. It's a divertissement, to use a French word. And, you know, Rattigan went on to write very many greater plays. But I think if you're a Rattigan completist, this is a very interesting production to see, because I don't know how long it'll be before the next one.
So you mentioned that he didn't actually write that many comedies, but when it opened, it was a huge hit, played over 1,000 times in the West End, and he was only 25 at that point. What do you think led to him changing his mind on the kind of material that he felt at home with?
Well, you know, sometimes it takes a while for playwrights to find their natural niche or to really write what they want to write as opposed to what they think they should write. I don't know, I wasn't around in 1936, to put it mildly, but maybe he was tapping into something of the prevailing commercial spirit of the day. And also, he might have wanted to just test his facility for dialogue. I mean, there's a lot of quite zingy dialogue in this, and there's some very, very funny jokes. And it's almost as if possibly he said, okay, you know what? I can do that. I can be bright and breezy. Now let's go for the harder stuff.
I do love a bit of a clever 1930s text. That is French Without Tears, which is on at the Orange Tree Theatre until the 21st of November. Now, Matt, we'll end today with the Donmar Warehouse for the premiere of Teddy Ferrara, which is a play by the American writer Christopher Shin and directed by Dominic Cook, who is the former artistic director of the Royal Court Theatre. This show is inspired by the case of Tyler Clementi, a New Jersey student who threw himself off the George Washington Bridge in 2010 after discovering that his roommate had used his computer's webcam to watch him kissing another man and then distributed it over social media. Now, Matt, I remember that particular incident, and it was certainly quite a big deal all over the world. It made world news headlines, and it was an absolutely horrific case when we heard it all come to light. And, I mean, there were a few differing accounts of what actually happened, but without doubt, he was certainly a victim of prejudice, no matter how you look at it. How do you think that is treated by this play?
Well, this play, and it saddens me to say for a lot of reasons, but this play is a quite considerable muddle. And although absolutely the Tyler Clementi case underpins it, and Teddy Ferrara, the title character, is sort of the Tyler Clementi equivalent in the play, spoiler ahead, something of that sort happens in this play, and Teddy Ferrara is not alive by the final curtain, but I guess you would expect that from what you've just said. But what Christian attempts to do, and it doesn't work very well, alas, is he attempts to use that is just one way of talking about attitudes towards gay, lesbian, transgender, what have you, on contemporary American campuses, something about the prevailing language employed on campus life in the United States, which is sort of its own language. It almost needs kind of decoding when the administration talk to the faculty and when they in turn talk to the students. It's English, but is it really English? What are they actually saying? And the central characters. Teddy Ferrara, although the play is named for him, he isn't actually the central character. The event that happens to him is the most dramatic, but the central character are these two young guys, students on campus, who briefly fall in love and then out of love, and they each act as a prism through which contemporary American gay life is refracted. And it's one of these plays, it's interesting, Christian and American writer, because what this suffers from is actually the kind of thing that a lot of British plays are said to suffer from, which is that the issue comes before the characters. And there are so many issues at work here that for much of the time you don't know really who the play is about or even particularly what it's about. And the ending, the actual ending, which has nothing to do with Teddy Ferrara really, is very strange and very abrupt. And it just makes me wonder whether there's another draft of this play waiting to happen that hasn't arrived yet. It should be said, on his behalf, the Christian, the playwright, has been openly battling cancer and is in remission from cancer, thank heavens. And this is a play that he wrote around the time of his diagnosis. So it's clearly a very personal experience for him. And I think that there's a better play waiting to come out of this material and of this text.
And well, as we said, it was certainly a very important issue when it happened, and it continues to resonate today. The dangers of online bullying certainly get talked about a lot in the traditional mainstream press, but it does feel as though it's one of those things that no one has quite got just yet. It sort of feels as though a lot of the older people that are writing about it in the mainstream press don't really understand what online bullying actually is until everyone who is engaging in online bullying has moved on and it's taking another form. It certainly hasn't been just a couple of nasty Facebook posts for about 10 years now, has it?
Right. Well, absolutely right, Ben. And nor do I think, actually, that this play expands one's understanding of it. For one thing, and this is obviously a considered choice, but for one thing in this play, you never see the bully, the actual bully. So all of that is just described, and it's described through the filter of Teddy Ferrara himself, who by that point doesn't seem a particularly reliable witness to events of his own life or anyone else's life. I mean, for one thing, in the on-camera escapades that he deals in, which you can see them play and find out what they are, it all involves him assuming sort of another guise. So who is the real Teddy Ferrara anyway? And when we meet him at the beginning of the play, he seems so sort of strange and disturbed and weird, and he keeps talking about canker sores in his mouth, and you think, well, is this real? Is he making it up? What's going on? That the clarity that I think you really need to address this properly is kind of instantly muddied. That the whole thing feels, I'm afraid, like a bit of a muddle.
Now, the real issue at hand here was actually one of the main points that started the whole It Gets Better yeah. campaign, which took over the world. It was spearheaded by the author Dan Savage. Yeah. Now, this is, of course, not the first the first play to take on a very important issue that has happened to the LGBTIQ community in real life. The Laramie Project is another sure. play that's been around for a long yeah. time, telling the story of Matthew yeah. Shepard, who, of course, was killed in an infamous bashing. When you put it up on that level and compare it to some of the other texts that are aiming to tell the stories of this particular community, how does it fare?
Well, the Laramie Project, which is a play I remember the original production of as if it were yesterday, is a very different kettle of fish from this. I mean, for one thing, it's much more direct. It's got a much greater impact. It focuses in very, very immediately and precisely. This uses Teddy Ferrara's stroke, Tyler Clementi, almost as a springboard to go off and talk about countless other things, and then it never really returns to the issue from which it started. And I just can't help but feel that Christopher Shin is empathic, obviously, to the situation that gave rise to the text, but he hasn't quite figured out what he wants to say about it. He's a very subtle and sophisticated American writer, it must be said, Christian, and maybe he thought, well, just to repeat the story that we already know in theatrical terms, that's too easy, and that is, in effect, what the Laramie Project did, and it did it very well. I think Chris would say, I don't want to do that. I want to take the story we all know and take it somewhere else, but he's sort of got waylaid in that process.
And we look forward to perhaps someone else having a tackle of this particular story at hand, which I'm sure will happen at some point. Matt, thanks very much. Teddy Ferrara is on at the Donmar Warehouse until the 5th of December. And that just about brings us to the end of today's show. My big thanks to Matt Wolfe for joining us on the program. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Ben Ryland. Join us again at the same time tomorrow when Arifa Akbar will be in the studio for this week's book review. But for now, thanks very much for listening, and bye for now.